Hi, and welcome to the Animal Training Academy podcast show, the show for animal training and behavior nerds, where I, Ryan Cartledge, interview the world's most proficient animal training and behavior geeks. We're absolutely thrilled and grateful to have you here with us today. So make sure you hit that subscribe button on whatever you're listening to this on so that you don't miss a single episode. Each episode of this show is brought to you on behalf of the ATA membership. And if you like the conversations in this episode, then you're invited to continue them with like-minded behavior nerds within the membership area, which you can find out more about at www.animaltrainingacademy.com. Once part of the ATA tribe, you'll get access to twice monthly live web classes, the back catalogue of previous web class replays, plus a huge library of videos and projects to help problem solve your training challenges. Plus, we're a sociable bunch with an exclusive private Facebook group and forum areas. It's like a Netflix social media platform for animal behavior geeks. But we will get started on today's episode, where I am very excited to welcome back to the ATA podcast show the amazing Melina DeMartini. Melina DeMartini Prince is renowned in the dog training world for her expertise in dog separation anxiety issues. She is the author of the book Treating Separation Anxiety in Dogs and has contributed articles on separation anxiety to multiple publications, such as the Association of Professional Dog Trainers, APDT, Chronicle of the Dog, Pet Professional Guild's PPG Barks from the Guild, and various national magazines such as The Bark. She lectures on separation anxiety at professional dog training workshops and conferences around the world, including everything from large professional conferences to small venues. She's also been interviewed widely on this topic, and multiple videos and podcasts have been produced. Melina is an honors graduate of the esteemed Academy for Dog Trainers, where she studied under Jean Donaldson, and is a member of the APDT, the Pet Professional Guild, and the International Association of Animal Behavior Consultants. So without further ado, it's my very great pleasure to welcome back to the ATA podcast show for the second time today, Melina DeMartini. Melina, thank you so much for taking the time to come and hang out with us ATAers.
I love the ATAers. Thank you for having me back, Ryan. This is the best. And, you know, I may be working within a small niche by working with separation anxiety, but I think it's an important niche. And so I'm so glad that you're willing to have me here to talk about this today and, you know, at other times. And I appreciate that so much.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. And everyone listening, me and Melina caught up a few times to plan this episode. And I think we spoke for about an hour on like two or three separate occasions. So, hey, why not push record, right? And share it with everyone.
That's right. I agree.
Now, if you haven't listened to the first episode Melina and I recorded together, that was released in September 2018, nearly 2 years ago. And we'll link to that in the show notes for this episode on the ATA website, or you can scroll back through the episodes on your device to locate it if that way is easier for you. In that episode, you can learn more about Melina's work and her process. So we're not going to cover that again today. Instead, later in the episode, we're going to discuss separation anxiety as it relates to July 2020. How does the current global situation with the pandemic and change in our routines influence our animals and their behaviors? But first, just so we're all on the same page from the get-go, Melina, would you please unpack and define for everyone listening what separation anxiety is?
I sure will. And I always love opening up with this question because there's something that is really powerful and meaningful when we talk about this. Separation anxiety is very akin to a panic attack that a human being might have about, say, flying or public speaking or spiders or snakes or, you know, heights or anything like that. And one of the things that those panic attacks have in common is that to someone that is not experiencing it, it is very irrational. And I want to point that out because for those of us whether we're dog professionals or whether we're dog guardians, it may seem that, you know, why would my dog be panicked when I leave him or her? Because I always come back. I always come back. He should know this by now. She should know this by now. But panic attacks, fears and phobias like that are not rational in many senses. And so just like the person that is afraid of flying on an airplane, when they know that they are more likely to be injured in a car accident, they know that logically and cerebrally, but they cannot disconnect that when they are on an airplane. And this is the same that's happening with our dogs. These panic attacks, this phobia, fear, anxiety is not rational in our mind. And the reason I want to make that point so strongly is that we need to understand that there is no way to just control the barking, control the peeing and pooping in the house, control the destruction without getting at that underlying panic, without getting at that underlying fear and anxiety. And so, you know, sometimes we'll get contact information from people that have dogs with separation anxiety, and they say, well, you know, my dog is barking all day. I need to get that under control. And it's really important that we express to people that we can get that barking to stop, but not if we don't get that underlying fear and anxiety to be under control.
So I remember just before Summer was born, and I'd taken Wifey down to the midwife, and I was sitting in the car with Phoebe, and I had my KPA cert looming, a baby about to be born, the membership, a bunch of other projects, and I was in the car and I could hardly breathe. And I was like, and I got out with Phoebe and put her on the lead, and I felt nauseous, and I didn't quite understand what was happening. And I said to my wife after, I was like, this just happened to me. She's like, you just had a panic attack. And I was like, I put a label on it. Some of the observable behaviors were shortness of breath, nausea, racing heart, and putting a label on it kind of helps me, I guess, when someone else says they have a panic attack, think back to my own experience and build some empathy. But how do we build that empathy in dog owners who don't have experience of what it's like to be a dog?
I agree. I think it's such a great question. And I think, you know, we talked to, in the last 20 years, we've talked to hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of you know, dog guardians. And every time we frame it in saying your dog's experiencing extreme panic and anxiety, their heart is racing, they probably can't hold their bladder or bowel sometimes, and they're acting out in disruptive ways because they are so scared. I think it's really important to get those messages across to people. And I actually personally am fairly direct with the clients that I speak to, and I say, it's your dog's welfare that is at issue here. And I know that it is disruptive to your life, but you need to look at the welfare of the dog in front of you in order to fix this problem. And are you willing and able to do that? And so I tend to be fairly direct about it, depending on the client. Of course, some people are softer than others. But it's really important that people understand that there is suffering occurring. Suffering. Like, it's not just like, oh, my dog's barking all day. No, your dog is suffering. And if they can get on board, and the difference between them getting on board with empathy and compassion for their dog versus saying, I just need the barking to stop, is the difference between probably making the kind of progress that we need them to make and not making the kind of progress that they need to make. If they just say, I've got a week and I've got to have my dog, you know, fixed, or else I'm going to drop him off at the shelter, we can still work with that, but we're probably going to need more as they start to realize that the suffering is occurring.
And do you find owners need a lot of explanation. I'm thinking back to yesterday when I was at the chiropractor, and last week a few weeks ago, like, my back went, let's just frame it like that, and I couldn't get up off the floor. So it was pretty bad. But before that, I wasn't really having any issues, and since then, I haven't really had any issues. And I was at the chiropractor yesterday, and he's like, so what kind of exercise do you do? I said, well, walk the dog. And he said, well, maybe you should do some exercise every week to get your heart rate up. And I went, can I be honest with you? I was like, that's not going to happen. But I was just like, oh, my God, I'm a dog client. Like, I'm a dog training client. Like, you know, I'm not going to do the things that I need to do to get better. But also was conscious that I didn't get any explanation as to why I had to get my heart rate up. Just told I had to get my heart rate up. And my body's like, nah, I got a 3-month-old. That ain't happening. So how important do you think it is to explain the why and kind of dive into the weeds with owners? I understand that every owner's an individual, but just general Melina's thoughts on that.
Yeah. I think the why is actually more important than the how, always. For probably everything from chiropractic and getting your blood flowing and, you know, heart rate up to separation anxiety. I really think that people need to, there's a motivation behind that. So, you know, your doctor said, well, you've got to get your blood, you know, your blood pumping, got to, you know, get your heart pumping. But he didn't tell you why. And maybe he did later, I don't know, but, or he didn't. Okay. And I'm not a doctor, so I can't even surmise to say why that was, you know, particularly important for your back injury. But I do think that if we understand the why, the how falls into place. If we believe in the how really falls into place. And I will give you an example of that. We ask people to not leave their dog alone during the training. And that doesn't mean that they can't be with a friend or a family member or, you know, stay with a partner or, a local dog sitter or something like that. But we ask people to do that. And when we first explain that, we explain the why. Because if they understand that the dog is going to suffer if and not make progress, if we don't do that, then they're like, oh, well, now it makes sense. If we just say, by the way, you're just, you know, not going to be able to leave your dog alone for a while. There's no reasoning behind that. And therefore, there's no motivation. And motivation is so key in what we all do every day, whether that's doing exercises to help your back or whether that's doing exercises to help your separation anxiety dog.
You know, like you said, if we believe in the why, the how really falls into place. And I'm remembering, I think it's Simon Sinek, his TED Talk. I don't know if you've ever seen that, you know. And Apple started with why we're going to put 1,000 songs in your pocket versus we sell MP3 players. I don't know if that fits perfectly into...
I do understand your reasoning there, though.
and I always talk about the why of Animal Training Academy, and I'm putting my faith in the universe that the why falls into place with that. But I think motivation is key, and I was very conscious of my motivation when I was at the chiropractor yesterday going, just immediately, my brain just went, nah. But when I said to the chiropractor, I said, can I be honest with you? Like, I want to be honest with you. Like, I'm not going to do that. I'm struggling at the moment and you're asking me, you know, what falls out of my life if I do that? If I start doing exercise, what am I not doing that I was doing now when I already don't have time to do what I'm doing now? And I'm also thinking about dog clients that I've worked with who get told one thing by someone else and they tell them that they're going to do it. And then they come to me and I seem to have built up trust with that person where I can honestly say to them, are you actually going to do that? And they can tell me, no, I'm not going to do it. But they tell the other person what they think the other person wants to hear. And I kind of felt like that pressure situation in the chiropractor yesterday. I was like, should I tell him what he wants to hear? And I filled out a survey, like, why would you recommend our chiropractor? And I said, because I don't know any other chiropractors. So how important is that for separation anxiety cases to get honesty and truth between your clients?
It's crucial.
And how do you build that?
And one of the things that I tell my clients is that, like, I or the CSATs tell their clients, I'm here because I want to help you and I want to help your dog. And there's only a specific path that we can follow. And I will never, ever put your, you know, mental, physical, financial, or time bandwidth at risk if you're not willing to do the work. And so it's interesting, and I will tell you this, Ryan, I think separation anxiety clients are unique. It's a self-selecting group, right? There's a lot of people that the first time that their dog destroys the front door or eats up the couch or whatever, that's it. They're out. They're at the shelter. They're dumped off or, you know, somewhere. These people that are like, I want to work through this issue because I love my dog, they are a self-selecting group and they jump on board. And we say, you know, jump, and they say, how high? And I'm not diminishing their commitment. I am actually so thrilled and impressed with the commitment that these clients have. But they know that it's either I fix this over time, or this dog is not going to be able to thrive in my environment, and I'm not willing to give up on a family member. And I think that family member is what most of our clients believe that these dogs are, and they are. I feel very strongly about that. I would give up my house and live in a box under a bridge, but I wouldn't give up my dog, you know?
Yeah, I think that would resonate with this particular audience that we've gathered for the ATA podcast show. As mentioned, our last episode was in 2018, so nearly 2 years has passed since we released that. I'm curious to know, in that time, what's been the most exciting change in your thinking, methods, and special research between this and our last episode?
Okay, well, I have sort of a twofold answer to this question. And the first one's going to sound a little bit like a plug, but I that's not my purpose. And I've got a new book coming out in October, and it's really heavily research laden, but written in very, you know, simple language that, you know, people can look at the research if they want to, or they don't have to, and they just know that it's there. And I'm really excited about that because I have distilled the research starting in the 1970s all the way through 2020. And it's incredible. Separation anxiety has been the number one researched behavior issue in the last four decades amongst the you know, behavior analysis and behavior research. And that's above aggression, believe it or not, from a research perspective. But the one thing that I think is really interesting is that there was a study done by a researcher named Ogata and some of his colleagues, her colleagues rather, and they said what's so interesting is that the treatment etiology and prevention of separation anxiety has yet to be researched and remains very elusive. So we know a lot about causational potentials, correlational potentials. We don't know about the treatment. We don't know about the why, the etiology, and we do not know much, if anything, about the prevention. And so just in the last literally couple of months, we've started to see some treatment research starting to happen. And I think that article and some others inspire that to say, what does the treatment look like? And so I think that's really exciting. You know, but I do want to say there's so much to be learned. And I'm hoping that the book that will be, you know, published in October will give people an insight as to what the research says, what we really know now, and what we really understand about the treatment that can be very efficient, but maybe is not yet fully proven in the literature.
And what year was that, Ogata?
Ogata, and I won't say the first name because I'm going to blasphemize the first name. It's Ogata was in 2016, and she but I did not receive that paper until recently. I don't know why I didn't. I wasn't on the, you know, on the pulse of that. And it's actually, for anybody that loves research, it is such a good, it's such a good research paper, because it reviews everything to date, well, in 2016, that that has been researched on separation anxiety and all of the influences and factors. And some of the things that it shows is really, you know, eye-opening, where we're like, oh, we decided that breed specifics don't have anything to do with it. Oh, but we also proved that breed specifics do have something to do with it. So, you know, it actually, it shows everything, like the good, the bad, the ugly, the, you know, the, you know, the contradictions, the correlations, the causations. I think it's a really good study. And I've gone through so many research studies now, and I continue to follow them day to day, including those that have just recently been put out in 2020, Daniel Mills' paper, Erica Furbacher's paper that was just recently put out a couple of days ago, I think. A couple of hers, actually, not just that first one or that one. There's a couple of them. And they are starting to dive into the treatment just a little bit more.
And so does it resonate with you that we don't know all of these things? Or you're like, we know more than the paper suggests?
Well, at the risk of sounding arrogant.
Yeah, sorry to put you on the spot, but I kind of just did.
You did, right. At the risk of sounding arrogant, I do feel like there are some very, very specific treatment protocols. And it's always a study of one. It is always a study of one. But I do feel as though what we've been doing for the last 20 years has been really efficient and effective. I'm not a PhD, I'm not a doctorate, and I have not published, you know, research, although there's some published research that will be coming out soon. But I do feel like what we see is tremendous success, and I want to make sure that somehow we cross those boundaries between academia and the boots on the ground people like myself and the other CSATs, and say, can you look at this? Can you please look at this? Because this is working, and it has been working for 20 years.
And I'm grateful for your book, because I'm not as good as I'd like to be, and I feel critically reading through literature. So I appreciate when people gather that literature and put it in layman terms for me. Thank you for that. Okay. And there's some great collaborations on that book. Are we allowed to share who illustrated?
Of course, the amazing and ever esteemed Lily Chen has of Doggy. Say it right for me.
Doggy drawings.
There we go. Doggy drawings. I was about to say doggy illustrations, and I knew that sounded wrong. Doggydrawings.com has illustrated quite a bit for the book. And I absolutely adore her, and her illustrations are so poignant, and I think it's so important to have that. You know, it's interesting when we're doing a book on separation anxiety, or really any topic that involves a dog being distressed. Looking for dog images of dogs distressed is actually distressing. Like, we don't want to put dogs in a situation that they're distressed. And so I'm very, very not comfortable to say, well, let's put a dog into a uncomfortable or a distressing position just to get a photo. I would never do that. And so I think those doggy drawings are amazing.
You said that the literature showed that breed-specific stuff was important and then it wasn't important. And that's the whole point of science, right? I remember Susan teaching in her LLA class, like, 1 year research shows coffee's good for you, the next year it shows it's bad for you, but that's the whole point. So I'm curious, after reading all of the research you've read, after, you know, I'm assuming that creating a book is firstly an outpouring of your knowledge and experience and into written form for us, but also a great learning opportunity for you. And I can only assume it generates a ton of questions as well. So I'm wondering what are you, after having done this for as long as you have, what are your big questions? What are the questions that keep you awake at night?
Well, I will tell you, one of the things that we recently, that some of the recent research divulged, was that dogs of smaller size or mass, meaning under a certain number of pounds or size, are more likely to have separation anxiety. And that is one that keeps me up at night, because I try to look at my client load and I think, you know, that's not really true. But then I do look at my client load again and I think, well, got more small dogs, a little bit more on the small dog side than the large dog side. I don't know why that would be. I truly don't know why that would be. But the research, with all the p-values and all the stuff that they tell us, shows that small dogs may be at a higher risk for separation anxiety. I do have my theories on that. And one of them is that I think small dogs are more likely to be in citified environments as opposed to out in the suburbs, right? And if you're in an apartment building and your dog yaps for a couple of minutes or more, you're going to get a complaint. If you're out in the suburbs in a single family dwelling and your dog yaps for a few minutes, you're probably not going to get a complaint. And I think that is affecting the research. I think people's reactions, the human side of the reaction, or the neighbors or the landlord or whatever, are influencing the data to a certain extent, because just a couple of minutes of barking, which could be just normal, like you left and I'm bored and I'm looking out the window and I see a squirrel, could create a complaint, which then could turn into my dog must have separation anxiety because I'm getting complaints from the neighbors. So I don't know, but that one keeps me up at night. And I'll tell you something else, Ryan, about the breed specific. I'm on the fence on this. I think even in our last episode, we talked about this, maybe that wasn't with you, but about 10 or more years ago, people, when I would do seminars and stuff, would say, what do you think about breed specific separation anxiety? And I said, and I used to always answer this 10 or more, probably 15 more or more years ago, I used to say, I don't know why, but I have a huge population of pit bulls that have separation anxiety. And people would be like, wow, that's really interesting. And then technology hit and I was able to do things like Skype and Zoom and, you know, other platforms. And so I went from just my local region to a worldwide audience. And suddenly I realized, oh, well, the reason that there's a high propensity of pit bulls that have separation anxiety is that I live in the San Francisco Bay Area, where there's a high propensity of pit bulls as dogs, right? And then when I started going out into the world market, I realized, you know, in Belgium, there's these dogs. And in, you know, France, there's these dogs. And in New Zealand, there's these dogs. And that it's not necessarily breed specific, in my opinion, or my thoughts, it's what is the main concentration of dogs? If you are in, and I don't even know this to be true, but if you're in Germany and dachshunds are your main breed, you're going to see a higher propensity of separation anxiety in dachshunds.
I was thinking about some political examples there, but I've decided not to go into those. Hey, if it's been the biggest researched behavior-related diagnosis, trying to carefully choose my words and probably doing a terrible job of it, is obviously reinforcing for the scientific, for the academic community to research it, seemingly. I don't know if I can frame it that way, but I'm going to go with it. Why do you think, why?
I think because it's such an enigma. And I think that it's probably also, from a research perspective, one of the few behaviors that can be emulated, not in a lab per se, but think about this. If you want to study dogs that are reactive on leash to other dogs, you've got the environment that not only includes dogs, but includes people, includes leaves blowing by, includes garbage bags falling, you know, flying past. If you've got separation anxiety, your dog is uncomfortable at home, and that is the one and only specific environment that they are experiencing this. And from a research perspective, that's a controlled environment, right? You're like, when you are gone, your dog is stressed. When you are home, your dog is not. Therefore, we can create parameters around what that means from a research perspective, because it is almost like a, you know, laboratory experiment. You know that the dog is comfortable in their home unless the owner or owners are gone. And so we can control the severity or extent of the stimuli, right? We can have them go out for 1 second or 5 seconds or 5 minutes. And we can look at that very clearly without any other interfering stimuli. And I think that's one of the reasons that the research has really glommed onto this, in addition to the fact that we have this elusive treatment, prevention, and etiology, and they're just trying to figure out more.
Well, grateful to all the academics out there.
We are.
Moving on, I'm excited that we are recording this episode, Melina, because I've had quite a few requests to make more content on separation anxiety, and with the global situation, the topic or separation anxiety has received, I would say, in my personal opinion, a lot of attention from our community as our routines change. And for a significant amount of us, we have spent more than the average amount of time at home. And then this changed again for a lot of us when some of us started to go back to work. Can you talk to this and your observations and thoughts over the last few months in regards to the conversations you've seen online?
Yeah, it's been a bit all over the map. Some people are in some, you know, media outlets and et cetera are saying, prepare for the worst, your dog will have separation anxiety. And then there's others that are saying, you know, not likely to happen unless your dog had a predisposition. And then there's others in the middle. I think this is a really unprecedented time. Well, we already know that it's a very unprecedented time. I don't need to state that. but we just don't exactly know what the outcome will be as people return to work or other activities in their lives. But I will say this. If a dog has had a predisposition to separation anxiety, in other words, you know, they used to experience separation anxiety, or they were always a little anxious about being left alone, but they kind of handled it, there's probably a much more likely percentage that that dog will have a regression or have some separation anxiety related problems upon the change in routine. For those dogs that have never experienced this issue, we just don't know. And I suspect that many of them will be, here's my technical term, will be bummed when, you know, mom and dad or whoever goes back to, you know, regular schedule, but that there will be some adjustment period and that they will reacclimate. The problem is that we don't know which dogs have really had that predisposition and which dogs have not. Some dogs have, you know, come into the environment and never really showed much predisposition because there was never any mitigating factors to apply to that, right? I had a client several years ago that had a dog that had some very, very mild, you know, discomfort with being left alone. And she contacted me and we said, okay, well, let's work through it. And then we worked through it. And a couple of months later, she had a double knee replacement, which is, by the way, who does both at the same time? I don't know, but that, you know, yikes. But for whatever reason, she needed that. And so she was home and laid up and unable to do anything for several weeks or more. And then when she was walking again, she was able, or, you know, with a walker and canes and everything else, she was able to return to work. And the dog went like down to like zilch ability to be alone. But I, you know, I really thought, well, this dog wasn't really comfortable with it to begin with. And then we had this long duration of this person being home. And that probably changed the tides. And so I wish I had a really concrete answer for this, but I don't think we'll know until we know. And I really recommend that people set up a camera, like, you know, a laptop or a tablet or whatever, or a smartphone, and watch their dog for a few minutes while left alone during this pandemic before they go back to work if they haven't already, and just see how that dog is reacting. Some of the things that we really can do is for dogs that did not have a predisposition before, you know, go out to the car and read a book for 15 or 20 minutes. Like, take little but intentional times away from your dog. And that will be important.
And do you feel that those working as consultants should be talking to their clients about this and recommending those types of strategies to go out and sit in the car for 20 minutes and read? And I was just thinking back to telling a client that in my experience at the chiropractor yesterday. Is that something that dog consultants should be worried about? Like, because I'm assuming that for a lot of people, clients, they might not have motivation. They're like, I'm not going to sit in the car for 20 minutes. Like, what are you talking about?
I think the way to start that conversation is by saying, we don't really know right now if this is going to be a problem. And so set up a camera and, you know, walk and take out the recycling, or, you know, go put the garbage in the bin, or go sit in the car for 5 minutes and watch your dog on camera with a smartphone and a laptop or a tablet. And if they feel there is any concern, then I think it is advisable for people to say, you know what, you're going to be sitting on your couch watching Netflix anyway. Go out to your car for 20 minutes and read a book. It's better for your brain and it's better for your dog.
So what is your gut instinct? If a dog didn't have separation anxiety tendencies beforehand, is this in fact a concern with our changing schedules?
I think it's enough of a concern, excuse me, that we should be looking at our dogs before we suddenly go back to work for an 8 or more hour day. I suspect that most dogs that did not have any tendencies before will probably have a couple of, you know, not so great days and reacclimate. And so my suggestion really is, if you have to go back to work on Monday for 8 hours, make sure you're maintaining or initiating relationships with a dog walker or a pet sitter or somebody that can break that day up for your dog, maybe once or twice a day. Even if it's not a huge exercise outing, at least you're breaking up that time if your dog has never had any propensity towards separation anxiety. But I really feel that before people go back to their daily lives, that they should look using you know, a program like Zoom, and make sure that their dog is not having any issues.
I think that's good advice. And building on that, in your opinion and experience and knowledge of the research, would you say, and we've talked about breed-specific tendencies today, and then now just thinking about individual dogs, the genetics of an individual dog. In your experience, are some dogs, like, have you seen genetic evidence? Some dogs, some like, and then their puppies and their siblings are predisposed to separation anxiety. And then with going into lockdown, are there some dogs that one might label as, appreciating that that label needs unpacking, some might label as borderline, and then can the lockdown situation push them into separation anxiety, or are you going to remember all of it? We can go back over.
I've got it. So keep it coming.
Or if a dog is likely to develop separation anxiety, what indications would we have potentially seen before lockdown occurred?
All right. You might have to remind me of that last one, because I think I'll forget that last one, but I've got the first couple. So there's sort of good news here, and it's good news depending on who you are. We have identified in the research and I'm not a geneticist, so gosh, don't hold me to the pronunciation of any of these words and things like that, but there is a haplotype, which is basically the genetic marker that is showing that when these dogs have this haplotype or this genetic marker, they have a predisposition to separation anxiety. And that's only happened in the last couple of years that this has been discovered. And I want to make sure that people understand one thing about this. This is actually, from what I understand, very similar to Alzheimer's research. You know, they found and I can't remember the name of the Alzheimer's gene that they found, you can now be tested for this Alzheimer's gene. And it's like, you know, L57212567 or whatever. I'm sorry, I don't remember what it's called. But and no disrespect to that in a condition, of course. I just don't remember. However, you can test positive and never actually have Alzheimer's. It doesn't mean that you will get the issue. It means that there is a predisposition in your body genetically to potentially have this problem, okay? And so it's the same that they've discovered with the genetics and separation anxiety so far, which is very new research. And one of the things I actually really love about this is I really, truly want people to realize that there is very little that people do that, like, could create the perfect storm to, like, I want to make my dog have separation anxiety and I'm going to do these 7 things. You know, it's really hard to do. But if your dog does have a genetic predisposition, it's not all that hard at all, right? And epigenetics play a role in this, you know, whether, you know, certain things are being, you know, from external stimuli are being turned on and off, et cetera. I think it's important that people really understand that. And so when we are faced with a pandemic like we are right now, even if these dogs had never expressed overt signs of separation anxiety, that doesn't mean that they didn't have some sort of predisposition. And that's where I think the confusion is going to come in when people say, well, my dog never had separation anxiety. I stayed home for 2 or 3 months and now he has it or she has it. I think that is going to be confusing because people are going to think, well, it was the pandemic that created it, but it may have already been there all along without any sort of outward manifestation.
My knowledge on epigenetics is very limited. I dare try to suggest that I know what I'm talking about. But I do remember reading about it in The Science of Consequences in Susan Schneider's book. And my understanding aligns with, I think, what you're saying is the environment can kind of turn genes on and off.
Correct.
And so if a dog has this haploid, I can say it. Haplotype? Haploid.
Haplotype.
Haplotype. Yeah. What is it? A haplotype is a marker on a gene.
It's exactly.
Mm-hmm. So specific environmental stimuli have the ability to influence that marker in some way?
Correct. So I'll go back to the Alzheimer's example. When people have this genetic marker, they're saying if you test positive for it, it doesn't mean you will get Alzheimer's. However, you should probably avoid drinking excessive alcohol or taking certain types of medications or, blah, 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 blah. I don't even know what the suggestions are for Alzheimer's. But in other words, you don't want to exacerbate and therefore flip that switch for that genetic marker by accident. I don't know, eat more spinach or whatever it is. These are ways that people can not necessarily prevent, but can influence how those switches are flipped on or flipped off.
I'm sorry, boss. I can't work from home because my dog has a separation anxiety haplotype.
That's right. Exactly.
And so the final part of that question is there some indicia? Now, this is a word that I had to Google to make sure that it was actually a word. Indications. It's like the whatever plural. No, I don't know. Anyway, stop talking, Ryan. Are there any indications that people might have seen before going into lockdown that would be cause for concern?
Well, it's a great question. The problem is that most people would not have looked at their dog on video prior to COVID and prior to lockdown. And so they would, maybe their dog is uncomfortable in pacing a little or whining a little or drooling a little or even just agitated in general. And they would never have known that because the reason that most people contact us about separation anxiety is that they are either destroying the house, they're barking, and the landlord or the commission or the neighbors or whoever are complaining, or they're coming home to pee and poop in their house. So if those signs that dogs are showing are pretty minimal, and I don't want to say, I want to emphasize this, I don't think they're minimal to the dog. They're minimal to the human, right? If they're just drooling and whining a little bit and nobody hears it, or pacing all day and nobody notices it, they may never know that that's happening. And I don't want that to be a doom and gloom moment because, we can look at our dogs now. We've got amazing technology to allow us to see our dogs when they're home alone, even if that's just for 5 or 10 minutes, to determine how they're handling their behavior and handling that alone time. Now is actually... It's almost embarrassing to say this, but if I could blame it on the dogs, I think they started this pandemic because they're like, this is the best thing ever. We want mom and dad to be home every day, and so I really feel like we could, because we've had this. Do you have this in New Zealand where we talk about the easy button? Is there that ad there? No. Okay. Well, but we could press the restart or the easy button where we've got this great 2 months or more of time that we've allowed our dogs to be in a safe environment. And that's important. And we can build on that. And if our dog did have a predisposition or is experiencing some separation issues, we can move forward with the training protocol. If our dog didn't, then we should watch them and make sure that they're, taken care of at least once or twice a day. So we break up the day for the first week or so they get back into the system of, or the process of being alone. And we can do a lot of things to help our dogs. And I just think in a weird way, we're in a time that is horrible and challenging and freaky for everybody, but our dogs could potentially benefit as opposed to be adversely affected because they've gotten this reset, they've gotten this break, and we can take advantage of that.
I knew it was a conspiracy, says Ryan, as he looks suspiciously at Phoebe lying down next to him.
Phoebe. It was all actually Phoebe started it, I'm sure of it.
She's like the brain from Pinky and the Brain.
She is the Pinky and the Brain.
What are we gonna do today, Ryan? Hey, I've lost my train of thought. Curious if you've made any adjustments and do you have any suggestions with regards to helping clients at the moment, considering what I would label as a general feeling of stress and anxiety during a global pandemic?
Yeah, I really love this question. And one of the things that I think people don't understand that when we're working, when the dog does specifically have some separation related problem, we ask people to spend about 20 to 30 minutes a day working on the issue. And that's 5 days or less a week. And so I think I'd like to get that out there so that people understand, like, this is not like you're working on this 3 hours a day, every day for, you know, months and months and months and months, like, you know, 20 to 30 minutes. And in that 20, 30 minutes, you can get errands done. You can walk out the door, come back in, wash the dishes, and then walk out the door and come back in and, you know, fold the laundry. I mean, you know, it's not so regimented that you can't incorporate other activities. And I just want people to know that we're not trying to add something really profoundly taxing to their lives if they do feel that their dog has separation anxiety. And I think, and I hope that people realize that, like, wow, I could, you know, just walk out that door and come back in and then fold laundry for a few minutes. That's not really taxing to my life. It's just walking out that door a couple times.
And so have you found you've had to, as resources as well become more scarce, so time might have become more scarce during the pandemic. And not only do you have your dog, or not only are you at home with your dog, but your kids are at home. So you've also got to think about them. And money for a lot of people has also become more scarce during this time. Have you, on top of kind of reassuring people that it's not potentially as large as it might be in their head, have you had any other changes to how you communicate with clients during this time, acknowledging that stress, anxiety, and change in resource availability?
I love this question. And one of the, I guess, I don't even know if it's a change, but I maybe have started to emphasize more that community is everything. It is everything. And with people that have dogs that are suffering from separation-related problems, having a friend, a neighbor, a family member, or a paid pet sitter, or a, you know, daycare environment, or whatever, or all of those resources, and preferably all of those, you know, one day at daycare, one day when I have to run to the grocery store, she stays at the neighbor's house, or the neighbor kid comes over and hangs out with her. You know, one day my mom comes over and watches the dog, or I drop my dog off at my mom's house. And creating that village, I think, is so important. And it doesn't have to be paid much of the time. Sometimes there are situations where, like, I really need to be gone for 6 hours today, and I'd rather drop my dog off at daycare than impose on my mom. But it doesn't have to be that way. And I want people to understand that creative solutions are really out there. You know, people say, well, my dog, I can't afford daycare, so I guess I can't do this protocol. And I don't believe that. I really think that the only thing that is limiting us is our creativity. And I'll tell you a quick story. I hope I didn't tell this one to you in the last recording, but if I did, it's worth reiterating. We had a client that moved to a new location, knew nobody, hadn't even started at her job yet, knew no friends, no neighbors, no family, no work, you know, relationships. And she said, I want to do this, but I don't know anybody. How do I find someone in this new state that I'm living in when I don't know anyone? And what we did was, do you guys have Meals on Wheels in New Zealand? All right. So same, you know, and there's a lot of different programs out there that are similar, but we created a flyer with, of course, this compelling, lovely picture of the dog and said, this is what's going on. And, you know, we made this beautiful example of, you know, what we needed. We needed some people to help with a couple of hours here and there. We asked the Meals on Wheels people to distribute them to the places they went. Not only did we get several people that were interested in helping to watch the dog for a few hours here and there, it was such an overwhelming response that the dog guardian had to create an online calendar because people were fighting over times to sign up to watch this dog for 3 hours or so here and there, right? Because, you know, these are people that are in a situation that maybe they're not mobile, or maybe they would love a little companionship, or, you know, love to take a short walk with an animal or something like that. And so, you know, I always use that as an example of, you may not know anyone yet, but there are everything from local gazettes to church bulletins to places you can ask, like Meals on Wheels and social media that can be arranged, and we can find those people to help us.
Final thoughts on topics related to coronavirus, global pandemics, and separation anxiety, and as you were saying then, that there are creative solutions. I was literally writing the word creativity on my computer screen. Recently, we had the pleasure of connecting with Steve Martin, and Steve Martin from Natural Encounters in Florida shared a quote from Walt Disney about dreaming, about the importance of dreamers. And he says, we need more dreamers. We need people. And I've been reflecting on that so much because, and I'm thinking about scarcity mindset versus abundance mindset. And we're in a time where resources are scarce and it's challenging and it's, it can be therefore challenging to be creative potentially because we have limited resources meeting challenges.
We do.
So I'm imagining that you've got many examples like the one you just shared, but I would like to step away from anxiety right now and jump into Melina DeMartini's mindset. how do you approach a situation like that? What is your thought process? How do you get creative in that space?
And I'm assuming you mean with the client?
Just when you've got limited resources and you've got a challenge, like the situation you just shared.
Yeah. You know, I think the way I approach it is, and, you know, maybe I'm very naive, maybe I'm very idealistic, I don't know, but I just feel like a community is huge, and there are always people out there that are interested and willing to help. And it's a matter of us finding them and certainly vetting them and making sure they're safe and not, you know, people that are coming to burgle our house or whatever. I just, you know, and I approach that with the clients in a way that I say, what can we do? Let's break your calendar down. Whether that's a 5 day a week, 8 hour a day, or whether that's a couple of days a week that you have doctor's appointments and, you know, soccer games with your kids, let's break it down and let's create the village that we need to have. And I mean, in 20 years, I have been able to find those villages with the collaboration of the client over and over and over again. And there are certainly clients that I talk to that they say, I would never be able to uphold that. And I say, okay, well, let me give you some suggestions and da, da, da. And literally within 24 hours, they call me back and they say, all right, got that figured out. Let's go now, you know, because, you know, if we give them those tools and the idea that this is really possible. I mean, how many people in this world love dogs? and would happily say, yeah, I would watch your dog for 2 hours every Thursday while you went to your yoga class or whatever. And you could say, sure, great. I'll exchange that for, you know, a thing of muffins or a bottle of wine or whatever, right? And or nothing for that matter. I mean, and that's the kind of community that I want to live in personally. I want to know those people that are like, let me help you and you can help me. And next time I need help moving furniture, you're going to come over and help me because I watched your dog a couple times, you know? And so I don't believe that there is a limitation to finding those people. I really don't.
And say yes more. Don't do what Ryan did at the chiropractor and immediately say, no, that's not going to happen. Hey, thank you so much for all of us. Sadly, we are now at the what I'm going to call the final question for this episode. Melinda, 2 years ago, we asked you to take us into the future and share with us what you would like to see happen over the next 5 to 10 years in the animal training world. Now, I appreciate that length of time has not passed yet. However, before recording today, I went back and listened to your answer to that question. And you spoke what I would label as passionately about how separation anxiety seemed to be a popular term, and that is evident by the consideration that you get asked to feature in all sorts of publications, including men's magazines, and that potentially the word gets used too loosely, and therefore we have to ensure as professionals we are being just that, professionals, and ensuring our diagnosis of an approach is done with best practice and with something you emphasized was with collaboration. So I'm curious, how do you feel we have done over the last 2 years? And is this still what you're most passionate about moving forward over the next 5? Well, let's say 8 to 10 years now, because 2 have already gone.
Sure. 2 have already gone. Yeah, in a way, I'm still equally as passionate about it. But I am really proud to say, not proud because I've done anything necessarily, but I'm very honored and excited and thrilled to tell everybody that progress has been made. The collaboration is happening. It's slow. And change is always slow, and we know that. I mean, big change. But, you know, recently there was a great research article that was put out by a prominent individual that was talking about, hey, how come we're not agreeing that we should be not leaving these dogs alone? And I was like, oh my gosh, it's happening. The word is spreading that we need to, you know, safeguard these animals and protect their welfare. And even in the book that I just, you know, I'm about to publish, I reached out to some really amazing individuals and asked if they would be willing to review the book. And they were like, yeah, we'll be interested in doing that. Can't divulge those names yet, but I will say that was really exciting for me because those people just a handful of years ago would have been like, yeah, no, we're not buying that yet. We're not on that. We're not on board yet. And so I'm really, really excited to see that, well, yeah, we're not at our 5-year or 8-year or 10-year goal yet. We're moving in that direction. And there is a lot more, and maybe some of this is from the pandemic that people were becoming more aware of potential separation anxiety. Maybe this is from other things, but I just think there's a lot more awareness and people that are sensitive to this issue and wanting to make a change.
So the words celebrate approximations come to mind.
Celebrate approximations. That's exactly what we're talking about.
Hey, once again, thank you so much for sharing everything today, Melinda. Just before we do officially wrap up, could you please just let everyone listening know where they can go to find out more about you, your work, what you do, and to get in touch?
You bet. My website is www.melena, M-A-L-E-N-A. DeMartini, DEMARTINI.com. And there's a lot of offshoots from there. And we also have our Facebook group, which is Treating Separation Anxiety in Dogs. And you can follow us on Instagram and all that kind of good stuff. But go to the website. There's one of the things that I really am happy about is that there's a lot of great blogs and information that is free for you to use, or for anyone to use and to read and to peruse, and to be able to move forward from there.
Wonderful. And we will, of course, link to all of this in the show notes for you listening as well. This has been so much fun, Melina, from myself and on behalf of the ATA audience. We really appreciate you taking the time to come on the show today again. It's really appreciated. Thank you.
Thank you, Ryan. I appreciate you so much and everything that you do.
We do, of course, really appreciate all of you tuning in today as well. And if you have enjoyed this episode and you were interested in carrying on the conversation about working with our animals in the most positive, funnest, choice-rich ways, then as mentioned at the start of this episode, the Animal Training Academy community is waiting for you. Head on over to www.animaltrainingacademy.com and click on the membership button in the main menu to learn more about what members are describing as the Netflix social media platform for behavior geeks. There's something there for absolutely everyone, and we're looking forward to having you join the tribe. That's it for this episode, though. We're going to wrap it up there. Thanks again so much, everyone, for listening. You'll hear from us again soon.